You're running through a field, being chased by bugs swarming after you, or you're really sick, you can't breathe, and you have a fever, and then you wake up. Hello, Avani Dias here, and this is the Hack Podcast. Those are just some of the most common dreams people are having all over the world during the pandemic. And on this episode, we're going to talk about what our dreams are telling us about our own anxieties. It's super interesting. And we're going to talk to one of the world's leading researchers in this space. Plus, a review of our country's environmental laws is happening for the first time in a decade. We're going to talk to the Federal Environment Minister on this podcast about why she wants to speed that up.
Hack.
There's actually no affordable properties to rent.
On Triple J.
You're trying to move house, looking through places to rent, and you're thinking, everything is so expensive. And yep, you're right. Turns out, only 3 places out of tens of thousands assessed for a report were affordable for people on youth allowance, and that includes share houses. The data shows even with coronavirus welfare payments, things are still really tough when it comes to finding a house on welfare, and young people are facing worrying rates of homelessness as numbers of people needing support have gone up during the pandemic. Shalala Medora explains, and just a warning, this story discusses mental health and suicide.
I was displaced and had no sense of belonging and nowhere to really turn.
Chris had a turbulent and unstable home life.
Dealing with a lot of mental health issues, tied in with drug and alcohol abuse issues, as well as domestic violence and homelessness.
By the time he was 17, he'd been kicked out of home and was couch surfing.
It's a bit like putting petrol on a flame when you're trying to suppress that with alcohol and drugs, which in turn is only going to make it worse. Dealing with day-to-day life while all that's going on, that's when things start getting really out of control.
He spent a lot of time going in and out of psychiatric facilities.
I'd be there maybe once a month. It got to the point where I didn't feel like I had a place on this earth. I'd convinced myself that the only way out was suicide.
After another admission to a psychiatric facility, Chris was encouraged to reach out to Tal Dumundi, a youth crisis support service in Sydney's north. It was a breakthrough moment for Chris. For the first time in a long time, he knew he had a bed to sleep in. It meant he could focus on getting better.
I met other kids there who had experienced similar things to myself. This is all the beginning of when really things start to change.
Chris is now 21 and he's just moved into a share house for the first time.
Where I am and the people that I'm living with and the job that I have and my current mental state, it's a whole nother person.
It's hidden homelessness. They aren't walking the streets. They're not on park benches. And that's not what homelessness looks like for young people.
Lisa Graham heads up Tal Dumundi. She said young people like Chris are the most likely to seek support from her service.
Primarily, it's the increase in family breakdown. So obviously we have a fair few young people that are escaping family violence.
The stress and tension caused by coronavirus is making life worse for families with existing problems, leading to a spike in the number of young people finding themselves without a stable home.
We've seen astronomical increase. We had 54 young people in March looking for accommodation. We have probably a little bit more than that in April. But a lot of those young people we haven't been able to help, so the turnaways are very high at the moment.
Tal Dumundi has 65 beds, but only 7 in crisis accommodation.
Last month we turned away 19 from the crisis accommodation because the beds are full.
It's a trend replicated around New South Wales. The number of people of all ages seeking temporary accommodation has risen from 900 in March to nearly 2,100 in April. But other states and territories are faring a lot better.
We've in general actually been seeing some reductions in rough sleeping.
Adrian Pizarski heads up National Shelter. He says emergency coronavirus measures, like the rent moratorium, have led to an overall decrease in people seeking homelessness support.
Because state governments have been quite active in providing hotel rooms and other accommodation options for particularly rough sleepers, but also people in refuges and things to allow some social distancing.
But he acknowledges young people as a specific group face unique challenges.
They are generally on lower incomes. They get lower levels of income support than the general population. They're often in casual and gig economy work. lots of those jobs were the first ones to go. So it doesn't surprise me that in some instances services will be experiencing young people approaching them.
Then there's the affordability of rentals.
There was nothing in our major capital cities.
Casey Chambers heads up welfare group Anglicare. Every year they look at how affordable private rentals are for people who receive income support, like job seeker, the disability support pension, parenting payments and youth allowance.
It's particularly bad for people who are single. It's particularly unaffordable.
And young people living off youth allowance find it the hardest to put a roof over their heads.
We tested almost 70,000 properties and three of those would have been available and affordable for somebody on youth allowance.
That's three all over the country. And that number includes share houses.
Similarly, for somebody on what was called the New Start Allowance, now Job Seeker, if you were a single person, there would have been nine individual properties.
Anglicare even factored in the additional $750 coronavirus supplement that the government recently announced when they looked at the affordability. The number of suitable properties increased slightly, but still remains a fraction of overall listings.
It really does show us that the private rental market is not serving the purpose for people in Australia on low incomes.
Triple J.
Shalala Medora with that story. And if it raised anything for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Hack. So I had this dream where basically I was in a pokey room at a pub and I was gambling. And then when I took out my winnings, the ticket just basically said positive on it. So I guess it was a metaphor for sort of the things I was doing where I was gambling with the coronavirus.
I just had a dream about a group of friends I met when I lived in London. We haven't spoken to each other for years, but it's made me so nostalgic for that friendship.
Hey, I'm Declan Byrne. I host Home and Host on Triple J. Pretty happy with hosting the show, but I had a dream the other night that management were looking to replace me, which was a bit of a punch in the guts. They actually showed me the list of who they were looking to get to replace me. And top of the list, believe it or not, was Lee Sales. Yeah, we'll see what happens at the end of the year. Lee, if you're listening, maybe stay at 7:30. I think it suits you. You know, there's not many interviews on Home and Hosed. No one to grill.
On Triple J.
Yeah, those are just a few of the dreams some of the Triple J team have been having. I must admit, I've been having some weird ones as well. What have you been dreaming lately? Humans have had questions for so long about what our dreams mean, what they tell us about ourselves and how they affect our lives. And we're about to get some of those answers. During the pandemic, people all over the world have been having really vivid dreams with links and symbols to do with coronavirus. And you know how you often forget your dreams after you wake up the next morning? Apparently, we're actually remembering them more. And there are actual reasons for that. Have you been having coronavirus dreams? Call me, 1-300-055-36. Harvard researchers are doing a worldwide study speaking to thousands of people everywhere about their corona dreams. Deidre Barrett is one of the researchers. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard. Thanks for joining us on Hack.
Nice to be here.
So you found a new phenomenon that people are experiencing called coronavirus pandemic dreams. What's going on there?
People react to any major crises or trauma by dreaming about it a lot. We basically dream about the same things we think about by day. So a lot of the dreams about the pandemic are similar to past major stressors, but there's some distinctive things to the hunkering down that we have to do for this one. I have an online survey going, and I've collected about 5,000 dreams so far from around the world. They're falling in several major clusters. A lot of people are dreaming about the virus itself, about getting sick. They suddenly can't breathe, or they're spiking a fever, or in dreamlike ways, one woman looks down at her stomach and sees blue stripes on it and remembers that that's a sign of the coronavirus. And then there are a lot of metaphors. Bugs are the most common. Every kind of bug in the world is swarming after people attacking them. We use the word bugs as slang for having a virus. And also just lots of little things that cumulatively could kill you is a good metaphor for the virus. But I've seen tidal waves and tornadoes and fires and just kind of every natural disaster standing in for how people feel about it.
What are those, you know, tidal waves and the bugs and everything representing in our minds?
Well, dreams are so visual that when you're terrified of something, the dream is trying to latch onto a visual image. After 9/11, I collected dreams, and there were such automatic visual images that they didn't need metaphors as much. And most people saw buildings falling down and planes crashing into things and hijackers with knives in their anxiety dreams about that. But for this, the average person doesn't have one or two clear, scary images. So it goes all over the place. Although, like I say, bugs seems to be a good metaphor. There's some monsters. Some of the monsters are said to be invisible. You see the effects of their attack, but you don't see the monster. I think that's, again, a specially close metaphor. With the healthcare providers in my sample, they have very graphic visual images of what it looks like when someone is dying of COVID-19. So they're having just very classic post-traumatic nightmares where they're at their hospital and they're trying to save someone and it's going wrong and the person is dying and they're feeling responsible. They're having dreadful dreams, but the average person's dreams are just more anxiety dreams right now.
And what is going on in our brains that means that we're all collectively dreaming in a very similar way right now?
Dreams are just our mind thinking in a really different chemical state, and our visual areas are much more active. Our emotional areas are somewhat more active. Our verbal and logical areas are damped down some. So it's normal to think about all of the same thoughts and concerns that we do by day, but in this very metaphoric, visual, looser thinking sort of way. And that's how we're seeing the pandemic reflected.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J. We're talking to Deirdre Barrett. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard, and she's been researching the idea of coronavirus pandemic dreams, which we all seem to be having a lot at the moment. Deirdre, I don't usually remember a lot of my dreams, but at the moment I can retell you all of them pretty vividly. Not all of them, that's an exaggeration, but I definitely remember them more than I usually do. Why is that happening? Yeah.
You may not be waking up with an alarm, although I bet you usually do, or you're sleeping a little more, or they're just more vivid, so they get your attention. I mean, our waking thought is somewhat more emotional and different in response to this, and the same is true for our dreams. People are just having more dramatic, more bizarre dreams. Unfortunately, most of them are anxiety-tinged, but some people are having happy dreams about other things, or even there's some positive dreams about the pandemic. I've read dreams where people get it, but they cure themselves in some way, or they don't necessarily have it, but they discover a cure for the world for it. Leeches and cat saliva figure in two of those. One woman dreamed she was a giant antibody running around killing the virus herself. So there are some kind of masterful dreams that make people feel better about it.
Obviously, there's the positive dreams, but, you know, I'd assume that a large majority are those anxiety dreams moving on to nightmares as well. What effect does having those kind of dreams have on our day-to-day lives when we're actually awake?
I mean, a few of the more novel ones may point out something that you haven't noticed, like one young woman had a dream where she was throwing a party and inviting her friends and talking them into coming, even though it was forbidden. And then secret agents from the government came and raided her house and closed the party down. And instead of being upset in the dream, she realized that she'd done something very bad and that she should be paying attention to these guidelines. And when she woke up, she said she had been ignoring them until that dream. And she realized that this was a life and death issue that she had to take seriously. So they can point us at something that we need to be looking at that's new, but mostly, just like with our waking anxiety, we're often going in circles of just worrying about the same thing over and over in repetitive dreams, and you wake up feeling a little worse than you did about it.
So what is your advice for people listening? How should they, I guess, analyze their dreams or use them to learn more about themselves or live their lives during this really stressful time?
I think it's a good time to start keeping a dream journal. Most people have more time for it, and it's really interesting to watch patterns of what you dream about the most. You can do a little informal dream interpretation by focusing on each element in the dream and thinking about what it means to you and what in the current situation is feeling like, whatever that may be a symbol for. But for people who are having lots of repetitive anxiety dreams that they just want to stop, the best technique for that is to think about what you would like to dream and come up with something like a favorite person or a place you'd like to visit, or lots of people like flying dreams. And then you can fall asleep telling yourself, I want to dream about X, I want to dream about X, and playing through visual images that about the person or the place or the flying. And that's a pleasant way to fall asleep. Tends to relax you and you're not focused on your anxieties. But also it often gets through to our dreaming mind. And it's not 100% guaranteed that you can't have a anxiety dream after that, but it makes it much less likely and much more likely that you'll dream about your target happy dream.
Dear Drew Barrett, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a new insight into our subconscious. It's very cool.
Enjoyed it.
Hack
on Triple J.
That's Deirdre Barrett. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard, and she's studying coronavirus dreams. So interesting. And we're getting some really great texts about the different dreams people are having. Someone says, my sister dreamed that she was being pursued by an alpaca the size of a giraffe. She had to feed it giant blocks of halloumi to settle it down. Woke up in a pool of sweat. Maybe that giraffe is coronavirus. I have no idea.
Hack. We're a world leader in destruction, but we've got such a magnificent environment. We need to be a world leader in protection.
On Triple J.
While so much of our attention is understandably focused on coronavirus at the moment, I want to keep updating you on other issues which may be neglected by other media because of the pandemic. Australia's national environmental laws are up for review at the moment, and that only happens once every 10 years, so it's a pretty big deal. Conservationists think we need to strengthen the laws to stop more species from going extinct. But as we face some major economic problems during COVID-19, other people say the act is too complicated and stopping development, as Joe Lauder reports.
So the EPBC Act is the Environment Protection Biodiversity and Conservation Act, a huge mouthful, but essentially it is Australia's national environmental laws. And the purpose of these laws is to protect our incredibly beautiful environment and our incredible wildlife that all Australians love.
Kelly O'Shaughnessy is the CEO of the Australian Conservation Foundation. Australia's national environmental laws, that mouthful Kelly named but we'll call the EPBC Act, are up for review, and it's a massive undertaking.
Right now, these laws are enabling extinction, enabling the destruction of habitat. So they're not doing what they are supposed to do. That's why the reviews are incredibly important.
These laws are 20 years old and they cover all issues that are considered matters of, quote, national environmental significance. So things like threatened species and ecosystems, water, the reef, and lots of other areas. Kelly says the purpose of these laws are to protect the environment, but she reckons they're failing to do that.
The laws were put in place 20 years ago, and in that time, 7 million hectares of threatened species habitat has been destroyed. So it's not protecting nature, it's not protecting wildlife. In fact, it's overseeing its destruction, and we need to change that.
This is a massive piece of legislation, and you can get seriously into the weeds if you try and go into all the detail. But one big issue that comes up a lot with this review is climate change. At the moment, the Act doesn't mention it at all. Samantha Hepburn is a professor of law and the director of the Centre for Energy and Natural Resources Law at Deakin University.
I think there are some serious flaws, and that comes from the fact that it's 20 years old and it doesn't respond to one of the most universally accepted environmental threats at the moment, which is climate change.
To pull out some Year 9 legal studies on you, most environmental laws in Australia are the responsibility of the states. But as we said, this EPBC Act kicks in for those matters of national significance. It's designed to help assess the impact of big projects on the environment and either knock them back or approve them. But the federal government can only assess them if they fall under these triggers or categories that are mentioned in the law. For example, in the case of the Adani coal mine, Professor Hepburn says it was only assessed on its impact on threatened species.
The trigger was activated not on the basis of climate change, which, of course, we don't have a climate change trigger under the EPBC Act, but on the basis of threatening endangered species.
She believes the Act should change to include a new category that looks at emissions and climate change.
Where a project has a significant carbon impact and potentially impedes our capacity to reach net zero by 2050, which is critical for, obviously, the world, but also in terms of our commitments under the Paris Agreement, then it needs to be referred to the Federal Minister for high-level environmental assessment.
The other big issue she thinks it should cover is land clearing.
Certainly land clearing. That's one of the other big issues. We don't have a land clearing trigger.
Because these laws are so broad, they impact so many different industries. One of those industries is agriculture. The laws cover a range of issues that affect the running of farms, like land clearing, water, threatened and invasive species.
It's too complex, it's not well enough understood, and again, doesn't apply to contemporary farming practices.
This is Tony Maher. He's the chief executive of the National Farmers Federation. He also agrees that these laws are in need of a massive overhaul.
Now, we're definitely not happy with how it works and its application and its intersection with state legislation and its relevance to agriculture. We think there are some perverse or unintended consequences from the Act that restrict agriculture and, in fact, provide, in some way, some specific cases, a negative environmental impact, which was not the intent of the Act.
But while the National Farmers Federation does want these laws fixed, they're not pushing for the inclusion of climate change.
Yeah, that's right. We do think that there are some changes that would allow for better practices and triggers aren't part of that equation. There is definitely a good balance between economic growth and development of, you know, a major sector of agriculture in rural and regional communities and environmental management and biodiversity.
Why do you think young people should care about what's happening in this review?
Look, in the end, laws are incredibly important to our society. We need national environment laws to protect our forests and rivers and reefs and wildlife for us, for this generation, and for the people that we love and for their future, because we depend on the natural world for everything.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J. Joe Lauder with that story, and the Federal Environment Minister Susan Lee is here. And if you've got a question about our environmental laws for the minister in charge, text me 0439 757 555. Minister, thanks for coming back on Hack.
It's a pleasure, Avani. Lovely to talk to you.
We've seen the effects of climate change and the way that it can impact things like bushfires, the Great Barrier Reef, and it's been so visceral this year especially. We know it's a huge concern for Triple J listeners, yet the words climate change aren't anywhere in our national environment legislation. Why not?
Well, climate change regulation is dealt with in its own act, and this act is about the environmental impacts on our threatened species. But listening to your piece there, it's a perfect example of why we actually do need to have the review that we're having now, and I welcome all of those different points of view. And Graeme Samuel is going to produce an interim report, publish submissions. It will be an open and transparent process, and people will be able to have their say once again in the second half of this year. So we're doing this well. We're doing this, can I reassure your listeners, with the protection of the environment front and centre. This was an act introduced by a Liberal government, and protection of the environment is front and centre in its objects and will remain so.
Minister, is it front and centre, though, when you're considering development projects under this Act and climate change is not one of those considerations, and researchers have pointed to the Adani coal mine and the approvals there, and climate change and the possible emissions of that project weren't considered under this Act. So will you be including climate change as a consideration there?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to say what the new Act may or may not look like. That wouldn't be right. It's an independent review. But can I just look at recovery plans?
What do you think should be in the Act? Well, you're the Environment Minister, so do you think it should be included?
I think our threatened species should be protected, and the recovery plans that we have in place are vital, and that's what features most often in the development assessments that my department does. So you mentioned climate change. The impacts of climate change on threatened species are taken account in the listings of those species. You mentioned bushfires and the Great Barrier Reef, and I'm very upfront too in saying that the threat of bushfires, risk and intensity is increased by climate change, and that climate change is the biggest risk threat to the Great Barrier Reef. But having said that, recognising that we're 1.4% only of global emissions, what we're doing is working out the things we can do and the investments that we can make in resilience and adaptation and response to bushfires. And can I also say, that is led by science. So after the bushfires, I put together an expert scientific panel. They've listed over 140 animals, over 400 plants, and now we're working at that detailed on-ground work to recover those burnt areas, to restore that habitat, and to do our very best for the trajectory of
and
those species.
Let's speak about those species, because we just heard in that story that 7.7 million hectares of threatened species habitat has been destroyed in the 20 years since this Act was put in place. So are the laws working to protect threatened species in Australia?
Look, I'm not sure where that figure comes from, but I do know that 12 million hectares was burnt in the recent bushfires, and that has generated our initial $50 million response, which, as I said, is actually finding its way to real action on the ground in those areas.
Okay, but I'm keen to ask you about that, those millions of hectares which have been destroyed, and a lot of that is to do with land clearing. There are many reports which indicate that that is the case. So is this law, this legislation which is being reviewed at the moment, doing enough to protect those species as you say that it is?
Often land clearing and indeed forestry come under state legislation. What we are, I hope, going to achieve is better conversations between the federal government and the state government when it comes to environmental impact assessments. At the moment, they do their own thing. They're states, they're separate jurisdictions, and they're able to do that. When we talk about land that is lost to species, some of that is because people live there. There are suburbs, there are developments, there is human activity. So this is all about balancing the impact of the human footprint, but also recognising that we have to get that balance right. And I'm always a little bit disappointed when I hear arguments from farmers on one side, arguments from inverted commas environmentalists on the other. I call myself an environmentalist. I have been a farmer. This is all about bringing people together and recognising that it's not about labels and it's not about litigation for the sake of it when it comes to a project that you may or may not want to go ahead. It's about a really sensible and sound process, and
Minister,
I really want to see that.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're running out of time, and I've got one more question I want to put to you, because land clearing that we're just discussing under this Act is at the centre of a scandal to do with your fellow Cabinet member, Energy Minister Angus Taylor. Today your department has found that critically endangered grasslands which are protected under this Act were killed by herbicide spraying on a farm which the Minister is financially involved in. Are you concerned about that?
There's been an independent investigation by my department's compliance team that is traditionally and always has been at arm's length from the Minister of the day. I've accepted the findings, and I'm not going to go into any detail beyond that.
On a broader sense, though, are we able to trust that your government has the interests of the environment at heart when situations like that are obviously going through and happening under this Act?
Well, I think you can look at our record investment of $1.9 billion in the Great Barrier Reef, at our response to bushfires, which I've described, at the work we're doing with our scientists on the front line in Antarctica when it comes to the southern weather systems that feed into the IPCC, the international experts on climate change, the $149 million that I've just released for our National Environmental Science Program. And I could go on. And I know it sounds like a string of numbers, but I'm hoping you get the sense that science is really at the heart of the environment.
We are about to hit the news, Minister, but I really appreciate you coming on the show and hope you do so again soon.
Thank you.
Hack on Triple J.
We got some great texts about the different dreams people were having. Someone said, I've been dreaming I'm a Russian World War II sniper, but it's not wartime, that I'm constantly laying in snow waiting for the enemy, but I haven't shot anyone, thank goodness. That's from Shane. And yeah, maybe the enemy is coronavirus there. And on Hack's Instagram, someone commented, I had a dream that my nonna and nonno surprised me and I got to give them both the biggest hug. That's really nice. And yeah, there are positive coronavirus dreams too. Thanks so much for listening. I'll catch you next time.